to be uprooted from the place that is most familiar to you, to leave behind those people, those possessions, those privileges which have made it home, to then be set down somewhere totally strange and be expected to begin a new life. This is likely to have been the recent experience of the first readers of this letter. Once living in Rome, here they now were scattered across what is modern-day Turkey. Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, and Bithynia, there in verse 1. What do these five provinces have in common? Well, one thing is this. By the middle of the first century AD, the Emperor Claudius had established a Roman colony in each of them. Those not needed, those unwanted on the emperor's doorstep, could easily be relocated to such places. For these followers of Jesus, it was expulsion. I don't doubt there is someone here this evening who knows firsthand what this is like. Beginning to feel the heat of persecution and suddenly discovering you're on the outside, you're a foreigner. The Apostle Peter now picks up his pen. He himself is still in Rome. Later in chapter 5, he refers to this as being in Babylon. Peter picks up his pen to write, and in so doing, is doing just what he's been charged to do. These believers are his flock. Jesus had said to Peter, take care of them, feed them. Despite having been scattered, they are still under his care. And as Peter writes, this is what these men, women, boys, and girls needed to hear. Even though they are now exiles in the eyes of the world, they are elect in the eyes of God, verse 1. Even though they have been rejected by the one, they have been chosen by the other, verse 2. This God, who is Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, has had his eyes set on them for a very, very long time. But there is something more that Peter wants his readers to hear. This message isn't simply, though we are rejected by the world, we are chosen by God, so take heart. If it were, then sure, that would be of some consolation when times get tough, but it wouldn't really help us stay afloat. What Peter most wants us to hear is this. As those chosen by God, we by definition become exiles and foreigners in the world. As those chosen by God, we by definition become exiles and foreigners in the world. Before any in the world get to pronounce such a verdict, God himself jumps in and trumps them. He has already disenfranchised us by saying, it's not out there, but here with me that you belong. So, it's not so much that we get uprooted from the places that we find ourselves. We have, in a sense, already vacated them. It's not so much that we lose possessions and privileges. We ourselves have forgone them. For our feet to one day be set down somewhere strangely new, that is now the trajectory we find ourselves on. This is true of the Christian, whether or not we experience rejection, whether or not we face active persecution. We're foreigners in the world already, irrespective of these things. The question that arises is this. What then are we to make of persecution when it does come? It had come for these Christians scattered over these five provinces. Throughout this letter, Peter likens persecution to being put into a blazing furnace. Well, for many of our brothers and sisters scattered throughout the world today, not least in the Middle East, this is exactly their experience. They could be consumed at any moment. Our experience here in London can hardly be said to come anywhere near. But even here, perhaps we are aware of ways in which the temperature is beginning to rise. 2 decades ago, to stand up and say, "I follow Jesus," well, you may have been viewed as a curious novelty, a hangover from a bygone age, but each to their own. Today, to confess being a Christian, in some places, well, it invites ridicule and scorn, or even a response close to hatred. Almost as if being a Christian isn't a respectable option. The temperature is beginning to rise. Perhaps you're only too aware of that in your workplace, among friends and family, even in your own home. It may already be too hot and too uncomfortable. The thing is, what will we make of persecution when it comes? Or perhaps the better question to ask is, what will persecution make of us? You see, what Peter doesn't say to us in this letter is avoid it. Neither does he tell us simply to endure it. Peter has something much more positive to say about it. And it isn't simply that we'll survive it. There are two possibilities for what can happen in a furnace. Something can be consumed by it or refined within it. Within the furnace of persecution, the same two possibilities stand open. A person may be destroyed and consumed by it, or they may be refined and grown within it. What makes the difference? What makes the difference? It all turns on whether you're at home or in exile. If in this world you think you're at home, you're going to respond to persecution one way. But if in this world you know yourself to be an exile, you're going to respond to persecution and suffering very differently. Peter wants us to know, to be assured, that for the chosen follower of Christ, persecution can have this refining purpose in our lives, to grow us as his disciples. Let's look together at the why, the how, and the what. Why persecution is able to grow us, how persecution works to grow us, what persecution grows in us. Firstly, why persecution is able to grow us. Look with me here at verse 3. Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. In his great mercy, he has given us birth into a living hope through the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, and into an inheritance that can never perish, spoil, or fade. A staggering thing has happened for the genuine Christian. The resurrection power of God, that power by which Jesus Christ was himself raised from the dead, has done a great work of bringing each of us alive, a new birth. What's now different about us as a result? Well, it's what we've been born into that Peter highlights for us here in verse 3. That is a living hope. Now, the things that we hope for are what set the course of our lives. If you want to buy yourself a Porsche 911, then that's going to require some extra hours in the office. If you want to give your children the best possible private education, that's going to take some tough lifestyle choices in the home. If you want to win the London Marathon, well, it may already be too late. The things we hope for are what set the course of our lives. So, change the things you hope for, and you change the course of your life. With the new birth comes a new hope, a living hope. Previously, our hope was set on things that we see around us every day, things that do perish, things that spoil, that fade. Yet still we hope for them, however uncertain they were. Now we have begun to hope in something different, something imperishable. This inheritance is kept in heaven for you, says Peter. Here, when we see that word hope, It doesn't carry the uncertainty and the doubt that we so often apply to our own use of it. Hope is here something certain, which we can look forward to with anticipation. Our inheritance, it really is already there, kept for us. How certain can I be? It's the resurrection of Jesus Christ that makes it certain. How certain I am of that links to how certain I should be of this. You may well have questions. Was Jesus really raised from the dead? Can I encourage you to come along to Christianity Explored tomorrow evening, where we'll be addressing just that. But through his resurrection, Jesus has secured. What has he secured? He has secured this inheritance for us, verse 4, and he has secured us for it, verse 5. And for the Christian, this inheritance is now setting the course of our lives. We're no longer looking for our inheritance here, whether that be in Rome, in London, or anywhere else. Is that true? Is that true of you? You may be only too aware that you're chasing after that retirement home more than hungering after what lay beyond it. Here's the thing. We've been given a new birth into a living hope. And as with any birth, this starts small. What's needed is a process of growing up. We all of us need to grow more and more into this hope until the imperishable starts to outshine the perishable. The good news is it will happen. The surprising news is that being in the furnace can contribute to this growth. So secondly, let's see how persecution works to grow us. How persecution works to grow us. Verse 6. In all this you greatly rejoice, though now for a little while you may have had to suffer grief in all kinds of trials. These have come so that the proven genuineness of your faith, of greater worth than gold, which perishes even though refined by fire, may result in praise, glory, and honor when Jesus Christ is revealed. Peter knows that trials, when they come, in whatever shape or form, they hurt. And with them comes real grief, even agony. There's no bypassing that for any of us. But what will be the outcome of going through this? If you're building your life on anything other than Christ, then severe persecution and trials can only destroy you. Why? Because they are an assault on the very foundations of your life. They are the intruders who have ransacked your home. And you're not sure how you're ever going to be able to rebuild. As you look around, you can find no reason for any of this, because in the end, it's all meaningless. But if you're building your life on Christ, if he himself is the foundation, and you know your home to be the inheritance which he has kept for you in heaven, then any trials that come your way in the here and now, however severe, can only grow you if you let them. Why? Because in the assault and the looting, even if you lost all you possess, in Jesus, you still have everything that really matters. The trouble is, we don't always see it that way. Most of the time, we're fixated on the treasure and trinkets we've managed to gather around us, and we assume that these are what give us life. But they don't. These perishable things could never give us life. And hard though it is to hear, the clearest way for us to see that these things don't give us life would be to lose them. To lose the perishable things helps us to recognize the imperishable things for what they are. To lose the perishable things in life serves to throw us upon the imperishable for our life. In this, says Peter, you greatly rejoice. There in verse 7, Peter likens the process to gold within a furnace. What is happening to a piece of gold as it comes under such intense heat? It is being refined. That which has no essential importance to gold being gold is melted away, driven off. It is recognized for what it really is, dross. And the gold emerges more glorious as a result. Yet even gold is perishable and will perish when the temperature has risen high enough. Peter has us here think on something far more precious, out of faith. Unlike gold, genuine faith won't perish in any fire. So, what's happening for the Christian under the heats of persecution? The dispensable is being driven off, so that which is indispensable not only remains, but comes to the fore. It is often in the midst of fiery trials that we recognize what truly makes for our life. And it sets our trust upon it as never before. This week we've been hearing of the death of Kayla Muller, an aid worker murdered by ISIS in Syria. During her captivity, Kayla had written a letter to her family in which she says, "I have surrendered myself to our Creator. Literally, there is no one else. And by God and by your prayers, I have felt tenderly cradled in free fall." When everything else had been stripped away, Kayla turned in the only direction she could turn. And that was sufficient. Trials, even those far less dramatic, will have worked a similar refining work in many of our lives. None of us would ever choose to go through them. But having come out the other side, or even while still in them, we can't deny that our lives are simpler, purer, and stronger as a result. Yet there's still some narrowing down and some focusing in that we need to do here. We're looking thirdly at what persecution grows within us. What is it that it grows within us? See verse 8. "Though you have not seen him, you love him. And even though you do not see him now, you believe in him and are filled with an inexpressible and glorious joy. For you are receiving the end result of your faith, the salvation of your souls." Friends, what are the authenticating marks of a true Christian? How do you recognize the genuine article? When all else has been stripped away so that we are left with, if you like, the kernel, the irreducible core, what is that? It's this: love for Jesus and an inexpressible joy. Love for Jesus and an inexpressible joy. The Apostle Peter, what had happened to him when persecution first came? He was with Jesus. He must have been aware of the temperature rising over those 3 years as religious leaders and those in authority began to set themselves against him. Peter, in that season, stuck close to his Lord. Then came the day when Jesus was declared public enemy and everyone turned against him. Jesus was arrested to be put on trial. Yet Peter still stuck close, the last man standing. Until, that is, hiding there in the courtyard of Caiaphas, the high priest, a young girl asked him, "Are you one of Jesus' disciples too?" Peter replied, "I am not." Whatever flame of love Peter had for Jesus, it was there extinguished. The next day, Jesus was crucified. On the third day, now raised to new life, Jesus stood there with Peter on the shore. They had just finished breakfast. with the other disciples. And Jesus turned to Peter and said, "Do you love me more than these?" That must have stung after his betrayal. "Yes, Lord," said Peter. "You know I love you." Jesus then asked him the same question again. "Do you love me?" Peter is resolute. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus isn't out to trip him up. He isn't asking the question to pile on guilt. He's kindling a flame. With the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead, a new hope had been planted in Peter's life, and a new love has been ignited in his heart. Jesus knows where Peter is headed. Peter is being sent to take care of the flock, to feed them, and that's going to take him into persecution. More persecution. Will Peter go the distance? Jesus asks him a third time, "Do you love me?" "Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you." And though more persecution would come, this love could never again be extinguished. Verse 8, "Though you have not seen him, you love him." Peter had seen Jesus. He had seen Jesus, but only of late came to truly love him. You and I are in this extraordinary position of loving him, having not seen him, having not seen him yet. To the casual onlooker, that won't make any sense at all. It can only be the result of a powerful work of God in our lives. With this love, verse 8, goes an inexpressible and glorious joy. Again, to the casual onlooker, the person undergoing the most fiery trials would seem to have little cause for joy. And yet, there it is, this inexpressible and glorious joy. Inexpressible because there's no earthly reason for it. Such a joy isn't there because of the trials. It is there despite them. We rejoice because we have a living hope of a certain inheritance that nothing but no one can steal from us. It has been secured for us, and us for it, through Jesus' resurrection from the dead. That is the very deepest ground we could ever have for joy. So let us rejoice, and rejoice greatly. See then the purpose that persecution can have in our lives. Those in the world around us may mean it for our harm, but praise be to our great God who takes it and uses it for our good. Let's be those who let it refine us for a life set on those things which matter most, which can never perish or fade. Let's be those who let it grow us in our love for Jesus Christ and into that joy that may be found in living for him. Amen.